Earlier this week, 47 Senate Republicans sent an open letter to Iran's leadership, warning about making a nuclear agreement with President Obama. This hour, the political fallout. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Political scientists Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa will give us their analysis of this week's rare direct congressional intervention into a president's diplomatic negotiations. Also, in her first news conference in 2 years, Hillary Clinton addresses the controversy surrounding her email and analysis of last weekend's Ag Summit, which featured a dozen GOP presidential contenders. Join our conversation this hour. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wednesday, Politics Wednesday has once again arrived, and joining us from our pool of expertise here in the state in the area of political science, we have Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa. Welcome to our studio, Tim.
Hey there.
Hi. Stefan Schmidt is with us in our AIM studio. Hello, Stefan.
Hi.
Great to have you both with us. And what a week in politics to look over three main elements that we want to look at this week. The letter written by 47 of the Republican senators, including our two senators here in Iowa, the Clinton email controversy, and the Ag Summit that happened this past weekend. Let's jump right in here. And listeners, we want to note 1-866-780-9100 is the way to join our conversation this hour. Well, the context for what happened in this first item we want to talk about, President Obama is working with leaders of five other world powers on a nuclear deal with Iran. President Obama argues that the pact would be the best way to keep Iran from obtaining a nuclear bomb, but critics from both parties, they are, say that such a deal might be dangerous. It would leave Iran with the opportunity to eventually build weapons that could be used against Israel or other foes. Then, at the start of this week, in this context, 47 Senate Republicans, including Iowa's Senator Grassley and Senator Ernst, sent an open letter to Iran's leadership warning about making a nuclear agreement with President Obama. This letter was organized by Senator Tom Cotton, a new name, a new face on our landscape, a freshman from Arkansas. It warned in the letter that, quote, "We will consider any agreement regarding your nuclear weapons program that is not approved by the Congress as nothing more than an executive agreement between President Obama and Ayatollah Khomeini. The next president could revoke such an executive agreement with the stroke of a pen, and future Congresses could modify the terms of the agreement at any time." End of quote. Let's listen to Senator Tom Cotton making these comments on CNN's New Day program yesterday morning.
47 senators of all tenures in the U.S. Senate recognize that we cannot allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon, and that it is critical that Congress approve any deal, and that they will not accept any deal that Congress doesn't approve. Again, it's an open letter. I welcome others to join us. Many have expressed the exact sentiments that we wrote in that letter, that Congress must approve any deal, even if they didn't want to sign it for whatever reason.
President Obama spoke to reporters about the letter during a meeting with the European Council president yesterday.
I think it's somewhat ironic to see some members of Congress wanting to make common cause with the hardliners in Iran. It's an unusual coalition. I think what we're going to focus on right now is actually seeing whether we can get a deal or not. And once we do, then we'll, if we do, then we'll be able to make the case to the American people. And I'm confident we'll be able to implement it.
River to River listeners, what's your reaction to this open letter to Iran's leadership sent by 47 GOP senators? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, where you can leave a comment or a question or tweet us at IPR Talk. Stefan Schmidt, your reaction. How do you size this up? If not unprecedented, a rare direct congressional intervention into diplomatic negotiations.
In 1985, Ronald Reagan wanted to support the Sandinistas, the Contras fighting the Sandinistas. Tom Harkin and John Kerry flew to Managua to meet with Daniel Ortega and to talk to him about ignoring President Reagan and that they would fix things and the Congress would take care of things. The Secretary of State at the time, which was George Shultz, was outraged and said it's not lawful for citizens to appoint themselves as negotiators for the United States. There was all this talk about the Dear Comandante letter that Kerry and Harkin had sent to Ortega. So it's not unprecedented, but it does annoy the heck out of presidents when members of Congress do this.
Mm-hmm. If we have to go back to the 1980s to find a precedent, it is rare.
Yes, it is. It is rare. And it happens at a time when the Democrats and Republicans, regardless of where they are in power, just don't agree with each other and don't trust each other. And clearly, Harkin and Kerry did not trust Reagan, did not think this was a good policy. And clearly, the members of Congress now don't trust Obama and think that he's basically doing something that will be harmful.
Tim Hagel, your thoughts?
Yeah, it seems like this kind of an open letter is maybe less addressed to the officials in Iran than it is to the President Obama. And that's, in fact, Charles Krauthammer basically made that same point
last night. Or to the American people.
Well, partly to the American people, but basically it's a reminder mm-hmm. to President Obama to saying, hey, look, you can't cut Congress out of the deal because President Obama has done that. He hasn't shown whether it's the willingness or the ability to work with Congress and negotiate deals on a variety of things. That's why he says he has his phone and his pen and has taken executive action. And Congress is as a third branch of government that they're saying, look, we're getting tired of this. And granted, it's a lot of it's political because of Democrats versus Republicans. But on the other hand, Congress is saying, look, we should be consulting us as well.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what position, Stefan, let me ask you this one, does this put the Democrats in? Because some Democrats have real reservations about these negotiations and the type of deal that might result from it. So is this forcing Democrats to choose between confronting Tehran with a tough line and rallying around the president?
Or also rallying around AIPAC and the Israeli lobby and the American Jewish lobby, which is very powerful and which generally supports Democrats. And so if Netanyahu says these negotiations are the death sentence for Israel, if we allow them to go through and capitulate to the Iranians, the Democrats clearly are in a between a hard surface and a rock, not Iraq, but a rock. And they'll have to weasel out of this. The thing is, I think the negotiations will go on. Probably Obama will cut some deal and then other things will pop up in the news that will take the oxygen out of this. But it is an interesting moment in American political jousting and also in the difficulties of basically defanging countries that either want to or have nuclear weapons. I mean,
What makes it an interesting political moment in your words, Stefan? What particularly about it? What will you be talking about in class, perhaps for years to come?
Well, I mean, you are talking clearly about this whole issue of the constitutional provisions and, who conducts foreign policy. And the Constitution, bless the founders, is, divided. The Constitution always kind of gives Congress some power and gives the president some power, or it gives the federal government some power and the states some power. So in some respects, at least, there are constitutional issues here, and it depends on what kind of a deal Obama cuts with the Iranians. It can't be a treaty because those have to be ratified by the Senate. So it can be some sort of presidential agreement, some kind of, off-the-books thing. That, in fact, the next president can say, well, I didn't sign that, so I'm going to sign another one that reverses it. So it is really a wonderful constitutional issue.
Okay, listeners, what's your reaction? Politics aside, if you can do that, do you feel this sort of direct congressional intervention into diplomatic negotiations by this president or any president is a good or a bad thing? 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Facebook. Tweet us at IPR Talk or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I think Bart in Des Moines has an opinion on this. Hello, Bart.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. What's your thoughts here?
Well, my thought is this is the last straw as far as the Republicans messing in negotiations of something of this importance. They've offered no solution. and they don't even know the deal, and there's, you know, you can't do that as a the Congress doesn't have no right to write no letter to a leader of another country when we're in negotiations. It's unprecedented. And I mean, this has been going on ever since he got there. They've been fighting tooth and nail, and they've offered no solution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for your view, Bart. As we discussed a little earlier, perhaps you went on, it was not unprecedented, but a rare occurrence. Okay, we'll let Bart take care of his dog there in Des Moines. 1-866-780-9100. Let's listen to, as I mentioned at the outset, we had 47 Senate Republicans signing this letter, organized by Senator Tom Cotton, the freshman from Arkansas. But among the signatories, Iowa's senators, both of them, both Republicans, Grassley and Ernst. Here's a comment that Senator Grassley made during his press call yesterday morning on the topic.
Now, there are agreements that are legitimate, but in this particular case, this is a treaty and it ought to be treated as a treaty, and we don't think the president's going to do that. And I also think it's right for Congress to speak out on this issue, because we have the right to ratify treaties under the Constitution. And we're also an independent branch of government. We don't have to do just what the president tells us to do.
Mm-hmm. So Senator Grassley yesterday, Tim Hagel, he seems to be saying there, walks like a treaty, talks like a treaty. So therefore Congress has to be involved.
Well, that's why we saw that it was the Senate that acted in this. If it had been the mm-hmm. House of Representatives, I think those that are complaining about it would have a little bit stronger case. But given that it's the Senate, and as Grassley was suggesting, if they see it as something that ought to be a treaty, then that's why they want to be consulted. And at the very least, even to the extent that it's something that President Obama can do through executive action or just general negotiations that wouldn't classify as a treaty, it's still usually a good thing to consult with members of Congress and get them hopefully on board. And the problem here is that there's just this great concern on the part of most Republicans and some Democrats as well that it seems, and again, as the caller was indicating, we don't know all of the specifics at this point because the deal hasn't been officially hammered out. But if it's going to be something that would lead to a greater possibility of Iran getting nuclear weapons, and that's something that they just don't want to see, the senators.
I asked about how this puts the Democrats in a bad position. But what about within the GOP? There's GOP infighting here. We had 7 Republican senators not get on board with this letter organized by Senator Tom Cotton, among them Susan Collins, Jeff Flake of Arizona, Collins of Maine, Bob Corker of Tennessee. He said he did not think the letter was, quote, something that would help us get to an outcome that we're seeking. He also said it would not have been constructive for him to sign it and express surprise that so many Republican senators did back it. So here we have a freshman senator coming up with a letter, having sort of a blitz organization of it, and all of a sudden you are a senator and confronted with this. This is an interesting thing to have sprung on you from within your own party, Tim Hagel.
You know, it is, and it's, again, unfortunate that the politics is intruding upon this, and it's not just a matter of Republicans wanting to oppose anything that President Obama does, but they've expressed for a long time, and by and large, polls seem to suggest the public is worried about this, too, of the possibility of Iran getting a deal. And some have suggested, including President Obama earlier in the process, that no deal is better than a bad deal, and maybe positions have changed and views have changed during the course of these negotiations. But the concern, again, of these Republican senators is that the way the deal seems to be heading is going to be worse and is going to accelerate the ability of Iran to get a nuclear weapon, something they simply do not want to see. Now, you can have some disagreement, as Corker and others have indicated, as to how you deal with that possibility in terms of the process. I doubt that they would disagree with in terms of what they're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Senator Jeff Flake, a Republican of Arizona, didn't sign it as well. He said the letter isn't helpful or productive. These are tough negotiations as it stands, he said, and introducing this kind of letter I didn't think would be helpful. Jeff Flake, Republican senator of Arizona. Stefan, your comment on how this breaks apart within the Republican Party, those that didn't sign it.
Yeah, I mean, both of our parties are divided, right? We know that both of our parties have various different factions that have different ideological and philosophical positions that answer to different constituencies. And so it's not surprising that you can't get 100% of either Democrats or Republicans on board something. But what the Republicans want is for the Iranians to commit to a forever commitment never to develop nuclear weapons. You know, their argument is, well, okay, so maybe Obama will negotiate, you know, a deal that for the next 10 years the Iranians are not going to pursue nuclear weapons, but then after 10 years, you know, the deal is off. And you can never get anybody to commit to forever on something. You know, so I think what we are is at a terrible moment when we know that Iran wants nuclear weapons, is well on the way to developing the technology to produce enriched plutonium and to build them. They've got the rockets to launch them with. And my own view is they're going to get nuclear weapons. I mean, the Iranians are incredibly persistent negotiators. They have had, you know, all kinds of sanctions imposed on them. The economy was hurting. They still have persisted. And you know, I think we've got to face the fact that more countries are going to get nuclear weapons, and some of them are countries we don't want. And so we've got to, you know, perhaps face that reality and build a regime that makes the use of those weapons more unlikely, like we had with the Soviet Union, which is, you know, if you ever use those weapons, there is not going to be an Iran on the next world map that appears. And I wrote a piece that we need to develop weapon systems that are credible, because what we have now are basically leftover weapon systems from World War One, not even two, which is barbed wire, rifles, airplanes, and boats. And they've been improved some, but we don't have a supremacy of the threat of you know, military action that is credible anymore, I think, or at least we're not willing to use it. I mean, we have nuclear weapons, but those are, you know, probably not ones that we can use.
Stefan Schmidt with us of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Let's go back to our phones. Calling from Dubuque, our listener, Jim. Welcome, Jim.
Hi. I guess I'm concerned about the 24/7 fear-mongering propaganda we have about this stuff. Mr. Netanyahu has been saying for 20 years that Iran is 12 months or 6 months away from developing a bomb. Everybody is ignoring that our own CIA and the Israeli Mossad both say unequivocally that Iran has no program, no evidence of an intention to develop a program to develop nuclear weapons. Their religious leader says it's against their religion, and they would like to have a totally nuclear-free, nuclear weapon-free Middle East.
Okay. Jim, some might ask if you're putting on rose-colored glasses here.
I'm talking about what the CIA and the Mossad say. I'm not saying what my opinion is.
Stefan, your reaction?
Well, ask the Saudi Arabians. They're deadly afraid, and they think that the Iranians, who are a huge threat to them and to some other countries in the area, would like to have that. They've built the kinds of missiles that are usable mostly to deliver that kind of a weapon. And so why are they doing that?
Let's listen. We're going to talk about Hillary Clinton in a moment in regard to the email controversy that's been also at the top of our news headlines this last week. But she made remarks about this topic yesterday at a news conference at the United Nations. And let's listen to Hillary Clinton, potential 2016 presidential candidate and former Secretary of State.
And one has to ask, what was the purpose of this letter? There appear to be two logical answers. Either these senators were trying to be helpful to the Iranians or harmful to the commander-in-chief in the midst of high-stakes international diplomacy. Either answer does discredit to the letter's signatories.
Hillary Clinton yesterday. Wow. What's your reaction to that, Stefan?
I always thought that President Obama and the Republicans in Congress had met secretly over a beer. And Obama said, look, I'll be good cop. Can you be bad cop, please? And can you go and tell the Iranians, you know, we're not going to put up with any weak agreement that you and this president of ours are going to cut, and so you'd better cut a deal that is credible and that will satisfy the members of Congress. And so Obama can go and Kerry can negotiate with them, and the Iranians will say, well, you know, if we don't cut a deal with Obama that these hawks in the Senate like, we're in big trouble, so we'd better negotiate a little bit more generously.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a couple minutes before we go to break about this new name on our political national political landscape, and he has come into here. It's a name I'm sure we'll hear about more. Tom Cotton, a freshman senator from Arkansas. He was the organizer of this letter. He has an Ivy League resume, as I understand, multiple tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, a veteran. All of a sudden, he's made quite a name for himself in the Republican Party, Tim Hagel.
Well, he has, and he was in one of the really tough races in the last Senate elections of 2014, one of the races that people were looking at very closely, and he was running against an incumbent Democrat at the time. And so it was not entirely surprising that he won, but it was still a pretty tough race for him. And so given his resume and so forth, that he is, you know, clearly somebody who speaks with a certain amount of authority. That's not to say that he has all the authority or that people that didn't serve that can't have informed opinions on this, but it certainly lends a certain amount of gravitas, I suppose, even though he's a freshman senator.
And I don't know if you gentlemen saw this news item from today, a lawmaker back in Tom Cotton's home state of Arkansas, I guess, who wants to make sure that this freshman Republican senator can run for reelection and the presidency at the same time in 2020, has introduced a bill that would allow House and Senate candidates to also appear on a ballot for president or vice president. You saw that, Stefan.
Yeah, but you know, look, Tom Cotton is a phony. He is a rhino. Tom Cotton, he went to Harvard. He wrote for the Harvard Crimson. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in government, and then he went to law school, and he was taught in law school by Elizabeth Warren. I mean, you know, this guy is more liberal than Mitt Romney, so no wonder they stuck him out there to be the guy to write this letter and to get all this publicity, because what he needed to do was to shore up his conservative and hawkish credentials, because on paper, he just looks like another Republican who has slipped off to the East Coast elites.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in a few seconds before we go to break, what's to become of this story? The Iran, what do you think will lasting impact of this letter when all is said and done, Tim Hagel?
Well, we just have to wait and see. I think that it's kind of one of these distractions at this particular point, but I thought that Stefan was making an interesting point talking about allowing the Republicans to play the bad cop, and I doubt that there was any any agreement over a beer that it was more of an unintentional sort of thing, and that may have been exactly what the Republicans were looking for, is just to remind them, saying, hey, you know, if you don't make a good deal, this is going to get reversed in 2 years when you have a new president, and from the Republicans' point of view, obviously a Republican president. And
not so that, not any spite, not just so, not spite involved.
You know, people are going to argue that, but you know, like I said, I think that the bigger concern is that, regardless of anything else, that it's trying to make sure that the deal is not one that makes it easier for Iran to get a nuclear weapon.
Tim Hagel is with us, professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Thanks for joining us on this Politics Wednesday. We'll continue after a short break, and when we do, we'll talk about the reaction to the Clinton email controversy. Perhaps you have a reaction. Is the criticism fair about her using this private email? Does this controversy change your mind about her as a possible candidate for president in 2016? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Back in just a few moments. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Does the Iowa Constitution protect abortion rights? That's a question being asked at the Iowa Supreme Court today as justices consider the issue of abortion for the first time in many years. Tomorrow on this program, we'll be discussing this and other cases currently before the Iowa Supreme Court, including the legality of a city's use of automated technology to issue speeding tickets, and another case that's pits the interests of a crime victim against the interests of the state. That's tomorrow on our program. We'll look at about a half a dozen cases currently before the Iowa Supreme Court with a couple of legal experts. Politics Wednesday today with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University. You'd like to join us, 1-866-780-9100. Let's jump into this email controversy surrounding Hillary Clinton. Yesterday, Clinton acknowledged that, in her words, it would have been better to use a government email address along with the personal one she used while Secretary of State at her first press conference since the controversy erupted earlier this month. But Clinton insisted she did not violate any federal regulation, never risked exposing sensitive information by using her personal email server. Clinton said she used a private account so she could carry just one device rather than both a personal and a government-issued phone. So convenience was a word she used a lot in her press conference yesterday. She said her email use fully complied with the State Department regulations. She has taken, since that time, unprecedented steps, she says, to turn over the work emails to the State Department for review. In her press conference yesterday, here are a few of the remarks that Hillary Clinton made.
I took the unprecedented step of asking that the State Department make all my work-related emails public for everyone to see. I am very proud of the work that I and my colleagues and our public servants at the department did during my 4 years as Secretary of State. And I look forward to people being able to see that for themselves. Again, looking back, it would have been better for me to use two separate phones and two email accounts. I thought using one device would be simpler, and obviously it hasn't worked out that way.
Clinton yesterday. What's your reaction to the Clinton email controversy? The criticism fair, or is it being made too much of? 1-866-780-9100. And let's go to Stefan first of all with this question. Stefan, did Hillary Clinton calm the storm of controversy?
Absolutely not. I spend most of this morning between classes and other assignments just talking to all kinds of people, many of them Democrats, a few Republicans, some face-to-face. And this thing is, it's iconic. It has so much stuff to it. In the short term, at least, it's electrifying and interesting. And I think it has legs. Whether the legs will go all the way to the Iowa caucuses and the nominating process is very difficult to tell because we don't know what else will happen. But it's absurd for Hillary Clinton to say, you know, she just wanted to carry one device when obviously email can be accessed from a device, one device, lots of different accounts. I do that with my device. She apparently has a BlackBerry and an iPhone, so she had two devices. And some people are saying she was playing, you know, the older grandmother who doesn't really quite understand technology and so on. Deleting the emails from her server raises a smell like you get in New York City when the garbage isn't collected during a garbage strike. I mean, that is absolutely a red flag. And there is never a question about security of her server. That's not the issue. The issue is, you know, what was in the emails? What kind of incriminating things happened? What Benghazi emails, you know, did she not give publicly or leave publicly that might reveal, you know, her failure during the attack on the Benghazi consulate? I mean, that's the issue. And the issue is, of course, the Clintons' penchant for secrecy and sort of hiding things.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, your view, do you see troubling aspects, as troubling as Stefan sees?
Sure. And there's always the problem here is that there's right now just the potential for this. We don't know so much. And as I was reading, one commentator was suggesting this morning that the problem, part of the problem is that for most government employees, the assumption or the presumption is that you do your work on your government device, whatever it happens to be, BlackBerry or something else. BlackBerry is what I had when I was at Department of Justice. And, you know, maybe then you do some personal stuff on it too. Whereas Hillary Clinton has reversed that, so that she can control everything. Mm-hmm. And so if you're somebody, like say when I was working in the government, I did all my official work, some personal stuff, and then I would have to identify, say when I left the Department of Justice, they say, well, did you use your BlackBerry for any personal stuff? And I had to identify those files or those emails. Whereas with Clinton, we don't know. She says she's making the State Department available all of her work emails, but she before giving them to the State Department, she got to select what was work and what was not, given what's going on with the Clinton Foundation and the funding from foreign governments and the fact that now apparently some of her top advisors, Cheryl Miller, chief of staff, and others were also using private accounts, that it all becomes very questionable as far as what's going on here. And again, at this point, we don't know, and certainly Hillary Clinton's supporters will say, we don't know if she did anything wrong. She says she didn't. We trust her. There are a lot of other folks that don't.
Mm-hmm. Is this criticism fair, River to River listeners? What's your reaction? A fair criticism of Hillary Clinton's email practices, or is too much being made of this? 1-866-780-9100. Zach is in Cedar Falls. How do you stand on that question, Zach?
Hey, yeah, I guess just for, I think, a lot of people, this seems really trivial compared to, I mean, the Republican letter to Iran almost certainly violates the Logan Act, but I think everyone else in the United States is thinking you've got the same people saying it's not cool for Hillary Clinton to use a Gmail account. And on the other hand, they're sending letters undermining a U.S. diplomatic mission to a foreign government. They're conspiring to undermine that mission. I think that the scale of what the Republicans does and what the Republicans are doing right now just outweighs.
Okay. Thank you very much for that comment, Zach. Let's go to Brian in Dallas County. A quick comment from Brian.
Hey, I agree with Zach 100%. This is such a non-issue. It's terrible. It's even being discussed on your program.
Okay. Well, it's being discussed all over the country, so we're not the trendsetter here. But thank you for your comment, Brian. 1-866-780-9100. We want to reach out here, too. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the Ag Summit last Saturday in Des Moines, when we had a lot of the almost every major potential Republican presidential candidate. Perhaps you attended that. We'd like to hear from you. 1-866-780-9100. Let's finish up with this and dovetail into 2016 as we do, because we want to ask, of course, with this email controversy, what do you think this means, Tim Hagel, for Hillary Clinton's possible bid for the White House?
Well, we have to wait and see. I didn't think that the email business was going to be as big a deal as it even is now. Now, that's not to say it will continue to be so. Whether it'll have legs, it may for a while. We'll see if it has any long-term effect. I think it may be slightly reduced the possibility that Hillary Clinton will get into the race, only because it reminds her of how much she hates the media and hates the process and so forth. And she may just say, oh, boy, I'm just not going to
deal with this. Did you see any signs of that in that press conference?
Kind of, that she just seemed to be disgusted with the whole thing. You know, why do I have to talk about something I think is trivial and, you know, so forth. And as you can see, some of the callers agree with her on that. But on the other hand, it may also give some people that are thinking about a run for the presidency, if Hillary doesn't get in, an opening. Now, are they going to take it? Are they going to say, well, you know, maybe she is a vulnerable candidate, that somebody that I could beat if I were to challenge her? I'm not sure that's true at this point. She's still very strong for the Democrats, but I think it does provide a bit of an opening.
Mm-hmm. And your read on the impact of this controversy, Stefan, on the 2016 bid?
You know, there are a lot of Democrats who have been waiting for somebody else to jump in because they don't like Hillary. They don't like the Clintons. They don't like the connections with Saudi Arabia and with countries where women are oppressed, at the same time that she's running around to the United Nations talking about women's rights and taking huge amounts of money from countries where women don't have any rights. So this goes far beyond the emails. There has been a huge percentage of the Democratic voter base who do not like Hillary Clinton. They never liked her. Go look and see what happened during the Iowa caucuses when Barack Obama ran, and she didn't get the vote, and he got the nomination, because around the country in many states that have, you know, Democrats with other values other than the Clintons, she lost. And so she has to look at what happened to her when she ran against Barack Obama in light of the revelations recently about the $2 billion that the Clinton Foundation got and so on. And a lot of Democrats are not going to forget this. And this is just one more nail in the coffin.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the Ag Summit. Perhaps we'll have callers about this, or other people weighing in who went to the Iowa Ag Summit last Saturday, convened by Iowa agribusinessman Bruce Rastetter, an event in Des Moines that attracted almost every major potential Republican presidential candidate, held before an audience of about 1,000. Also scores of Iowa and national political reporters in the attendance there. Bruce Rastetter asking questions. This is not where you stand at a podium or walk around a stage and spout. This is where you ask questions that Bruce Rastetter was handing them to them, and they addressed in detail a broad range of agriculture issues. Stefan or Tim, did either of you go to this?
I didn't go, but I watched the whole thing on on the web.
Stefan?
Yeah, same thing.
Stefan, what stood out for you when you looked at all these candidates? We can't, of course, discuss all of their performances, but what stood out?
Well, what stood out was that, I mean, and this is not my opinion. This is what I saw on some of the social media and some of the reports. By the way, the political reporter, the lead political reporter for The Economist, whose name is Lexington, that's his pen name, came and spent an hour drinking coffee with me and talking about this whole event. It was fascinating. So it was international media as well. One extremely wealthy individual is able to cattle call the Republican candidates and sit them down and sit across from them and drill questions at them. An extraordinary event. I mean, I've never seen anything like that.
Extraordinary
before.
In what way? In a good way?
Bruce Rastetter is a businessman. You know, he's not a politician. He's not a media person who is there to, you know, moderate a debate or something. They were coming to explain to Bruce Rastetter specifically how they would handle things like, you know, ethanol and renewable fuel standards and immigration and some other things. So that was extraordinary. And what was also extraordinary was what probably a lot of Republicans didn't expect, which was that Jeb Bush came out of this thing looking pretty good. And I think he survived the first sniff test. He got very good publicity from various other events that he did beside the summit. And I thought that was very interesting.
You mentioned Jeb Bush. Let's listen to a little cut of Jeb Bush. This is a more lighthearted moment at the Ag Summit on Saturday. Jeb Bush explaining his view of one of the issues that was before this Ag Summit, food labeling.
When I go to Publix in Coral Gables, which I'll do tomorrow morning after church to go prepare for Sunday fun day in my house, we'll be cooking Iowa beef and... And I'll probably make a really good guacamole, and I want to know where that avocado's from, and I want to know where the onions are from, and the cilantro, and all the secret stuff I put in it. So I like the country of origin labeling, and it's prevalent in supermarkets in this country.
Okay. You mentioned the renewable fuel standard. Let's listen to one of the other participants at the Ag Summit, Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, defending here his lack of the endorsement of policy to subsidize ethanol production.
Well, look, my view on ethanol and biofuels, I support biofuels and ethanol. I think biofuels have a major role in the energy market and that they're going to continue to have a growing role. I also don't think, and you and I have talked about this a number of times before, I don't think Washington should be picking winners and losers. When it comes to energy, I think we should have an all-of-the-above approach, but it should be driven by the market. Ethanol is a major player in the industry. E10, the refiners are used to it. The distribution system is there. The demand will continue without the federal mandate. But I think the right answer is to enable biofuels to keep innovating, to keep producing, and not have Washington dictating what's happening.
Okay, so Ted Cruz there on Saturday. Ethanol, the renewable fuel standard, Tim Hagel, there's been change in the Republican Party. Now there's really some for and some against, right?
Yeah, and usually the Republican Party, wherever you're at, is going to be more inclined to the free market. But of course, here in Iowa, because of our investment in agribusiness and ethanol and corn growers and the whole sort of economic situation that we have, the Republicans generally are in favor of it. And so it's sort of an odd twist in that sense. But it hasn't It isn't as important as it was, say, 16 years ago, thinking when John McCain decided to, when he was running for president the first time, that he just basically skipped Iowa during the run-up to the 2000 caucuses because he figured, well, I'm against ethanol subsidies. I'm not going to win in Iowa. I'm not going to compete here. And times have changed. And so people like Ted Cruz can come out and say, well, look, I'm still in favor of free market. I don't think that you should have subsidies. But as other people that were at the Ag Summit were indicating is that, well, you know, maybe we're opposed to it in general terms, prefer the free market. But unless other industries are willing to give up their subsidies too, that we're still sort of in favor of the renewable fuel standards. So there's kind of in a transition period at this point. And you do see some disagreement among Republicans as to how important it is and what approach they want to take.
One of the other participants on did you want to jump in there, Stephen?
Boy, I sure don't agree. I mean, we have always blended fuels, right? We've always had additives that go into gasoline and petroleum products. Those have always been chemical. Those have not been ethanol, but they have been petroleum-based additives. They were required as part of the blending process. I don't think Ted Cruz would object one bit if the blended fuels had products that came out of the ground in Texas mandated in them. The only thing that he doesn't want is to have a blended fuel that Texas doesn't produce that much of put into the fuel. It's not about free markets. It's about which particular industry in the country benefits from government mandates.
Let's talk about Scott Walker. He's polling quite well. I think he jumped out of the in the aftermath of the Freedom Summit put on by Representative Steve King, fared very well and has been polling well. Let's listen to him at the Ag Summit on Saturday explaining his stance on wind energy.
I support wind as part of an overall all-the-above energy policy. To me, we can be competitive in the world. Economically, we can also shore up our national security issues if we are more dependent on the abundant supplies of energy we have here in America and in North America in particular. And that means we shouldn't be just single out one or the other, but we should say all the above. I want as many different energy policies, or not policies, energy options as possible out there. And if I was in a position as president, I'd advocate for that.
Okay, Scott Walker polling well. Tim Hagel, this, as a fellow Midwesterner, is we're still many months away from the caucus, but he's in a strong position.
He is. He seems to be. Of course, we know that things change, that some people let look good early on for one reason or another fade or fail in one fashion or another. But right now, he does seem to be in what many people are considering the top tier, along with Jeb Bush and maybe one or two other people. So we'll have to see if he maintains that status, if other people come out. And I know that there's been, in the last couple of days, been concerns about how he has changed his position. So some are trying to label him as a flip-flopper, and we'll see if that resonates with the Republicans. Republicans or with whether Walker's able to explain his changes or not.
As we wind up this hour, caller from Fairfield, Francis. Francis, you were at the Ag Summit on Saturday?
That's right. My concern was that it was just kind of softball questions and an opening for sound bites for the candidates and nothing deeper. For example, like what about the water quality problems in the Midwest, nitrate in the river, the dead zone in the Gulf? What about the rural quality of life due to capos? And the erosion and the environmental problems due to ethanol. Now, obviously, Rathsatter, being an ethanol and a capo person where he made his money, wasn't going to ask those questions.
Mm. Okay, good point, Francis, calling from Fairfield. So how did this compare in your minds to Representative Steve King's Freedom Summit several weeks ago? Many more GOP candidates declined there, Stephen, to come on board for that one.
Well, there were a bunch of them missing from this one as well. Rand Paul dances to his own piper, and he doesn't want to, you know, go and answer questions like this. So you've got some Republicans who are going to try to do things on their own and are not going to participate in some of these events. I thought it was very interesting. But on the other hand, it's a year before the caucuses. So whatever happened there, much as Vegas, probably stays in Des Moines by the time we get to February of 2016. So
11 months, actually, Stephen.
Yeah.
Tim Hagel.
Yeah, one thing that was nice about the Ag Summit was it is a little bit different format, and although the caller was correct in the sense that it still did allow the candidates or the speakers, maybe we shouldn't call them candidates yet, officially, to stay on their talking points if they wanted to, and some did and some didn't. And it, at least it was more specific in the sense, but Rastatter really wasn't asking follow-ups. He did a few of a couple of the people that were speaking, but not too much in the way of trying to get a real back and forth. But he did sort of nail down, okay, let's talk about this, let's talk about that. You have a couple minutes to do so and so forth. So it wasn't like a canned speech like we saw at the Freedom Summit.
Let me leave you with this new poll, and our listeners, we can think about this. Remember how the election of 2008 was all about hope and change? Well, according to a new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, even more Americans are clamoring for change in the upcoming 2016 presidential election. In this poll, 59% of voters prefer a candidate who will bring greater changes to current policies, even if he or she is less experienced and tested. That's up from 55% who said that in July of 2008. So I guess that does that bode well or not well? I suppose not well for the Bushes and the Clintons possibly in this race, does it, Stefan?
Well, that's right. It depends on what the word change means. If it means, you know, changing foreign policy and the economy, an older, well-recognized person can do that as well. But if it means young, fresh faces, no, it doesn't.
Okay, thank you very much for participating today. Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, appreciate you coming into our studios today.
Welcome.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Also thanks to Julia Davis, and thanks in Ames to Jason Burns and Sean McLean. Our theme music was performed and written by the River Monks. Tomorrow on the program, we'll go through about a half dozen Iowa Supreme Court cases currently on the docket. Hope you'll join us then. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.